with extra dimensions, what can often happen is that you have a fundamental Planck scale that I'll call M star. And there could be a sense in which this fundamental Planck scale is much, much less than the Planck scale we see because of the structure of extra spacetime dimensions. So we'll see two ways to realize this. The first is that if you have relatively large extra dimensions, you can get a dilution by a volume factor between the fundamental Planck scale and the observed Planck scale. And this can push down the fundamental Planck scale close to the weak scale, which addresses the hierarchy problem. And that we're seeing a Planck scale that's actually reduced just from the way we're observing it. And the second connection is that our observed Planck scale could also be, or the one we see could be much less than the actual fundamental scale if we're somehow separated from where gravity likes to live in an extra dimension. So this will come in examples of warp extra dimensions that I'll get to later. So I want to start off with just a basic start, just to orient ourselves. And suppose we're working in d equals 4 plus n dimensions. And I'm going to assume this n part, these are the extra dimensions, are space-like, in the sense that in the sense that the metric signature matches up with the spatial dimensions that we have in our usual four-dimensional case. So in other words, this 4 is our usual 1 plus 3. These are the extra dimensions, and these extra dimensions are like these three pieces of the time. People have also tried to make time-like extra dimensions, but you get all kinds of causality and problems and weird stuff happening. So I'm going to concentrate exclusively on these things being extra spatial dimensions. OK. So now let's look at a gravitational potential in a local area with extra dimensions and assume that these extra dimensions are locally flat. The gravitational potential is going to satisfy what's essentially a Poisson equation, assuming it's static. And this is going to look something like 1 over m star to the 2 plus n times rho, where rho is the energy density. So this is just regular old Newtonian gravity, but with extra dimensions. And if you you take this equation and you solve it for a point source, if you solve it for a point source, what you get is a gravitational potential, or actually I'll say a phi of r, that looks like where this m is the mass of the point source. So in other words, with extra, I forgot a 1 here. With extra dimensions, this gravitational potential falls off more quickly, going away from it. And correspondingly, the force between a pair of point masses is going to look like m1, m2 over r to the 2 plus n. So this 1 plus n, if you think about solving this with, let's say, a delta function source, you can use your usual Gauss's theorem, and you see that in the usual sense, as my flux lines go away, they dilute. With extra dimensions, they can dilute into more dimensions, so they fall off more quickly. So we see that the force law changes in extra dimensions. But of course, we know that as far as what we can see from day to day, we live in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So if we want to realize extra dimensions, we should have an explanation for why we don't see them just in regular everyday life. And the way this can come about is if these extra dimensions are somehow small. And what I mean by small is that the extra dimensions are compact. And the compactification radius is very small compared to the radius, the radii that we can access. So let's parameterize our coordinates as follows. Actually, let me try to get a consistent notation. So I'm going to write x to the m as the usual x mu plus my extra dimensions I'm going to write as wa. So this mu, so this x mu is t x, y, z. And these wa's go from w1, w2, to wn, parameterize the extra dimension. And just for simplicity, let's assume that our extra dimensions are periodic with some radius r. So in other words, we identify wa plus wa plus 2 pi r. So with one extra dimension, this would be like this would be equivalent to saying that if this is my w and this is my r, it's periodic with radius r. And then generalizing this to more extra dimensions, you get an n torus. In any case, if I take this picture and I apply it to this gravitational Gauss's law and use it to derive the corresponding force law between point masses, what we get now depends on the distance little r compared to the compactification radius r. So for now, let's just assume I have the same r for all the extra dimensions. And it turns out that for small r, you get the same result. So this is basically what you expect. If you're much smaller than the size of the extra dimensions, you shouldn't see them. You shouldn't notice them. And in this case, you get, for your force law, something that goes like 1 over m star to the 2 plus n, m1, m2, r to the 2 plus n. On the other hand, suppose we have r much larger than the radius r. In this case, the flux lines are now no longer just able to expand out freely. Instead, they're in a sense stuck with the extra dimensions. And at long distances, and I guess in this case, long distances corresponds to these coordinates because these ones can't get that big. I'm essentially just stuck. I don't end up resolving this extra dimensional structure very well. And what I mean by that is you can check that the force law looks something like this. I get my same 1 over m star to the 2 plus n. I get an m1 m2 of r squared. But now from the extra dimensional factors, I just get a 2 pi r to the n. So now, for these large distances, my flux lines can only spread out freely over these r squared things, whereas this just represents the limited extent to which they can expand out over the extra dimensions. So comparing this to my usual four-dimensional case, I see that what I identify as my Planck scale, normally I'd have a 1 over m Planck squared here. Now this thing, my actual Planck scale is going to be this times this. So in other words, the Planck scale that I would observe as a large distance observer would look like 2 pi r to the n times m star to the 2 plus n. Which, if you look at this thing just corresponds to the net volume, the net n dimensional volume of the extra dimensions. So what we're going to see in theories of so-called large extra dimensions is we're going to have a fairly large value of r here. And this is going to imply, with this fairly large values of r, that we can get a small Planck scale for m star, for fundamental Planck scales on the order of a TeV, provided this r is big enough. And this will be the idea of large extra dimensions. We'll also discuss warp extra dimensions later on. And for that, the way m star will be related to m Planck will be a little bit different. But for now, let's move on with large extra dimensions. OK, and actually, but before I get into that, let me just put in a few numbers. Suppose we want our usual m Planck And remember that my Planck is always the reduced Planck scale, which is about 10 to the 18 GeV. And suppose we want M star to be on the order of about a TeV. We can take this formula and look at the size, the radius of the extra dimensions we would need to get enough volume dilution to get this. And it turns out that this corresponds to 2 pi r being on the order of 10 to the 32 over n times 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, where n is the number of extra dimensions, which depending on what my value of n is, so if I look at different n's and how much dilution I would need, n equals 1 doesn't work, because 10 to the 15 centimeters is a macroscopic size. And if we had a 10 to the 15 centimeter extra dimension, we would all be talking in 5 dimensions and not 4. But for n equals 2, you get 1 millimeter. 1 millimeter is actually kind of interesting. This idea of volume dilution was, as a way to address the hierarchy problem, was first proposed in sort of, let's say, mid to late 90s. And at that point, we didn't have any tests of the gravitational force law at distances less than about a millimeter. So when this large extra dimensions idea was proposed, n equals 1 was obviously ruled out, but n equals 2 was still viable. And it was kind of an interesting problem because, naively, you expect that, OK, if you could probe gravity at distances of 1 millimeter, we should be able to, or 1 millimeter seems like a distance we should be able to test gravity on. But just it turns out that gravity is so weak that nobody had ever done it. So to address this, various groups looked at various very sensitive experiments, usually involving torsion balances, where you have essentially two masses that you put together and you look at how much they attract each other. It's actually very difficult because you have to be very careful to cancel off all the other forces acting between them. But current limits on 1 over r squared gravity forces have been reduced to distances getting down to close to 1 micrometer. So these experiments actually rule out n equals 2 case, n equals 3 is possibly viable, and n equals 6 we can't really touch. OK. So before I get to the large extra dimensional scenario first, let me first talk about how you deal with quantum fields defined in extra dimensions, because this is what we'll eventually do when we look at these theories. OK, so for now, let's just look at a five-dimensional space where I have coordinates x, mu, and w. And I'm going to assume that w is periodic with period 2 pi r, or period 2 pi in radius r. And I'm going to, just to start off, assume that I have a flat space in the sense that my metric is just the usual thing, just with an extra minus 1 tacked on. So my extra dimension also is flat in this picture. OK, so if you write down an action for this theory, the action for, well, I guess the simplest theory I could write down in the extra dimension is I integrate over all the space-time coordinates. And I put in, so for now, let's consider just a scalar field in this extra dimension. So this is the simplest possible theory I can think of. I have just a real scalar with some mass term m defined in the extra dimension. So starting from this, we're going to follow what we usually do in quantum field theory. So if you recall, in standard four-dimensional quantum field theory, for a free field, we start off by looking at the classical solutions. Find the classical solutions, expand in a set of eigenstates of them, and we get our field expansions. So recall that for a four-dimensional scalar field, um, you write it this way, you have your where this is just the usual d3k over 2 pi cubed 2ek. And then you have that k0 is k squared plus m squared. So this is just the usual story for the expansion for a d equals 4 scalar field. So what we've done here, and what we're going to repeat up here, is these exponentials, either minus ikx and either plus ikx, are the solutions to the classical equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon, the del squared plus m squared equals 0. And our general field we write as a linear combination of these classical solutions with operator value coefficients. So we're going to do the same thing on this extra dimension. But now on this extra dimension, we have an extra spatial, coordinate that's of finite extent. So our expansion that we're going to do now is we're going to take our field phi, and now our field is a function of x and w, and we're going to expand it in a set of eigenfunctions of the four-dimensional part of an eigenfunction of the five-dimensional part of the action. So what I mean by this is we can take this structure and integrate by parts, and the boundary terms vanish at infinity because we assume the fields fall off at infinity. They'll also vanish on the boundaries here because we assume that they're periodic, so you have a cancellation there. And I'm going to rewrite my action as S as integral d4x, integral dw. When I integrate by parts, what I'm going to get here will be a 1 half phi, how shall I write this? I get a minus del squared minus, I guess, plus del phi squared phi minus 1 half m squared phi squared. So all I've done here is I've integrated the kinetic terms by parts, and I get a minus sign from moving things through. So the del phi corresponds to a derivative with respect to the w variable. So I want to write this in terms of eigenmodes. For the del squared piece, we'll have del squared plus m squared, and this will give us e to the ikx's. But we also have this del phi squared piece. And to get rid of this, we do a usual separation of variables. And the separation of variables corresponds to an expansion of this form. And the convenient choice is to choose these expansion coefficients to be eigenmodes of this operator, such that this piece just diagonalizes. So in particular, we want to choose these fn's to satisfy an orthogonality condition. And we also want them to diagonalize this operator, which corresponds to fn a w. And this includes a normalization factor and it shouldn't be as a surprise that I just have a set of exponentials with integer powers here. And the motivation for this is, we know that these are orthogonal in this sense. And we also know that if we apply del phi squared to fn, we're going to get back two powers of this. So we're going to get a minus n squared over r squared times fn. So in this sense, these fn's are eigenstates of the del phi squared operator with eigenvalues minus n squared over r squared.
Does this separation make our energy dimension of this field not variable? somehow? I mean,
yeah, we'll come back to that. So I'm going to rewrite this piece mn squared over r squared as mn squared in a suggestive way. Okay, so if I take this expansion and I plug it in above and I use the orthogonality property, what we find is the following form. My action reduces to an integral d4x. And I expand out. And one thing to note is that these expansion coefficients are complex valued. So if I expand everything out and I apply the orthogonality after plugging everything in, what I find is 0. So I have a piece corresponding to n equals 0 here. And it just has this form. Oops. And then I have the pieces corresponding to all the non-zero ends. And the pieces corresponding to non-zero ends assemble themselves, n equals 1 to infinity, assemble themselves into up a bit, assemble themselves as follows. Okay, so all that I've done is use this expansion of our five-dimensional field into a set of eigenmodes of the four-dimensional differential operator, and plug back in and expand it out. And what I see now as an effective theory is a free field theory. But now, instead of having just one scalar, we have lots of scalars. So in particular, we have this so-called zero mode. And it's called the zero mode because it corresponds to the zero eigenvalue of del phi squared. And if this m squared piece was 0, it would be massless. So it's only getting its mass from the original mass term we wrote in Lagrangian. On the other hand, we also have a tower of these states that we call KK modes. KK stands for Kaluza-Klein. And we see that the mass at each KK level is the sum of this thing I call mn squared plus m squared. So these correspond to a tower of scalars with physical masses m squared plus mn squared, which if I plug in mn squared, it's mn squared plus n squared over r squared.
Has this got very electric charge, right? So because we're summing from n equal 1 to infinity, we took the negative ones and put them into 5r or something like that.
Yeah, well, so, okay, so I haven't gauged anything yet, so there's no charge yet, but
They're complex,
yeah. And this complex combination just comes from the fact that my eigenmodes on the my eigenmodes on a periodic space are these exponentials. If I instead chose a finite interval, well, let's say Neumann or Dirichlet boundary conditions, instead of having the exponentials, I'd have sines or cosines, and then I would have just gotten real excitations. But in any case, I need to make sure that I assemble everything into something that's real at the end of the day, and it just comes out naturally from this. Okay, so this is my story, and this is called a Kaluza-Klein expansion or KK expansion, and what we've done is we've expanded our five-dimensional theory into something that looks like a four-dimensional theory, but now with extra particles. So our extra degrees of freedom can be reinterpreted from our four-dimensional point of view as looking like a tower of extra particles. One way to think about these KK modes and the corresponding KK masses is that because we have periodic boundary conditions, or equivalently, you could look at other extra dimensions that have a finite extent, because of the periodic boundary conditions, your momenta in the fifth dimension is quantized. So only certain values are allowed. You only have certain normal modes. And you can think of these KK modes as corresponding to fluctuations of the five-dimensional field with non-zero momentum in the fifth direction, whereas a zero mode has zero momentum in the fifth direction. OK, so this is our KK expansion. And if I had more extra dimensions, let's say I had more extra dimensions, they were all periodic, I could generalize this by now having exponentials depending on the other extra dimensional variables. It gets more complicated, but it's the same general idea. I can also put in interactions. So, for example, one interaction I could have written down is something in the action of the form, let's say d4x integral dw lambda phi to the fourth. And in this case, after KK expanding, it would go to something of the form d4x lambda 5 over 2 pi r, a sum over k l m n phi k phi l phi m phi n, the delta k plus l plus m plus n equals 0. So what you see here is I got a quartic interaction in my among my KK modes. And the quartic interaction, because these various k values have to sum to 0 by the Kronecker delta, this is another expression of the conservation of the five-dimensional momentum in terms of the effective interactions between these four-dimensional KK modes. Right. So in any case, these KK expansions come up all over the place. Here, we're doing it in the simplest possible case for a scalar in a simple flat extra-dimensional spacetime. We'll come back later and look at more extra dimensions. And we'll look at more extra dimensions and more impossibly warped or curved extra-dimensional spaces. So before I move on, let me just mention that suppose we had n extra dimensions in n. So in d equals 4 plus n. If all the extra dimensions were periodic in this sense, what we would have instead is we could write our eigenmodes as fn of w, where the w is a vector in the extra dimensional space. It goes from w1, w2, all the way to wn. And our fn's would just generalize into the 2 pi r, so the n over 2, e to the I n dot w over r, where n is some vector in Zn. OK, sorry. There are lots of n's, but yes.
Should some of the indices in the Kronecker delta have negative signs? Because the way you define our fields, n is always positive. And therefore, the delta function will only be 0, only be 1.
Okay. So what I've done here is this phi n. So phi minus n has been identified with phi n dagger. Sorry about that. Just for consistency. So these go over all possible negative values, and then I identify negative values with the daggers. Okay, sorry. Yeah, I should have mentioned that earlier. OK, but in any case, the generalization of this to big N extra dimensions is my eigenmodes are now exponentials, but now I have big N factors of the exponential. And I can characterize these modes by these N tuples living in Zn. OK, so let me move next to an explicit realization using extra dimensions, but with a standard model embedded. And this explicit realization is called large extra dimensions. And the large comes about because we're going to choose our radius. So we're going to have multiple extra dimensions. We'll assume that the radius is the same for all of them. And we're going to choose the extra dimension, the little radii, to be relatively large in this sense, such that we get a big volume dilution, and we move our fundamental Planck scale, our fundamental gravity scale, m star, to be near the TEV scale. So we use this volume dilution to move the observed Planck scale to be much less than the fundamental Planck scale. OK, and the idea of large extra dimensions, sometimes they're also called ADD, which stands for Arkani-Hamed. Dimopoulos and Diwali. So LED or ADD, I may flip between these two just to warn you. The idea here is you have D equals 4 plus N, where N is something between 2 and some bigger number. But for the standard model, we assume that the standard model lives on a four-dimensional subspace of the extra-dimensional spacetime. So the picture, let's say for n equals 1, for n equals 1, okay, well this is rolled out, but let's say we have n equals 1. So here's my extra dimension, w, and it's periodic with period 2 pi r. And at every point along this extra dimension, I can think of having a four-dimensional space. So my full five-dimensional space is some point in extra-dimensional space, and each point in that extra-dimensional space, I have a 4D space-time living at that point. The thing that motivated this large extra-dimensional picture is the idea of brains. And a brain is a surface. So these things came out of string theory. A brain is a subspace of a larger extra-dimensional space in which you can confine certain fields. So the idea of ADD is that the standard model is confined to a four-dimensional subspace that's stuck right here. And the standard model doesn't travel in the extra dimension. All the standard model stuff lives at a four-dimensional space at w equals to 0. But gravity, because it relates to the structure of space-time, necessarily goes everywhere. It necessarily travels in all the dimensions. So the picture of ADD is that I have the standard model living on a brain in a larger dimensional space. And so the standard model description is just the usual four-dimensional case. But we have, on top of the usual story, gravity in this extra-dimensional space. So the thing that led to this proposal was largely the advances in string theory, finding these brain solutions, where within the larger, in string theory, typically a 10 or 11 dimensional space, people found that you could have structures within them of lower effective dimensionality, and you could confine things to these lower dimensional subspaces. So again, we have a standard model here. Gravity goes everywhere. And what's going to happen in theories of large extra dimensions, or ADD, is that our standard model will basically look the same. But gravity is going to live in the extra dimension and will have a KK expansion. So on top of the usual graviton, will be identified with a zero mode, something that in this case is exactly massless. But because gravity lives in the extra dimension, it will have a KK expansion. And these KK modes will have non-zero masses from these KK mass contributions. So on top of our usual gravity, with on top of the regular gravity with the usual 1 over m Planck strength, we'll also find that you have a tower of KK gravitons. And the typical separation between the KK graviton masses will be set by 1 over r. And 1 over r for large extra-dimensional theories, unless I make n very large, 1 over r corresponds to relatively low energies. So a nice way to convert between energies and distances, and this is a good thing to remember, that is that the combination h bar c in appropriate units has corresponds to 0.197 GeV Fermi. And in our natural units, we set h bar c equals to 1. So if you want to convert between distances and energies based on our natural units, this is a handy thing to use. So this corresponds to saying that roughly 2 times 10 to the minus 14 GeV meter, or 2 times 10 to the minus 12 GeV centimeter. So for example, if I had an extra dimension of size 1 centimeter, this would correspond to this would correspond to energies 1 over r, energies on the order of something like 10 to the minus 12 GeV, or 10 to the minus 3 EV. So for n equals 2, for example, and n equals 3, we would expect that these KK mode separations and the KK masses are tiny compared to the GeV scale. So we're going to end up expecting to have lots of closely spaced graviton KK modes on top of the usual standard model case. OK, so let's do this. Let's take this picture and look at graviton KK expansions. So I'm not going to go through the full details, but I'm going to sketch out how it works. We take our full extra-dimensional metric, and I'm going to write it as GAB, where the A and B indices run over mu and little a. So A, B run over mu, and A. So these are the usual spacetime, 3 plus 1, and these are our n extra-dimensional indices. So we have our GAB, and we're going to expand it around locally flat space. So we're going to write it as the usual eta for flat space, the plus, minus, 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 plus small fluctuations. And our small fluctuations will be functions of usual spacetime and the extra dimensions. And we're going to normalize it as follows. So this normalization is chosen such that this, this field, which we'll identify with the graviton, is a scalar field. Well, when we expand it in KK modes, we'll have the appropriate dimension for, even before KK expanding, we want this to have the appropriate dimension for an n-dimensional scalar field. And it turns out that this gives the right answer. OK, so we take this and we plug it into our gravitational action, which is just an Einstein-Hilbert action generalized to the extra-dimensional space. And the generalization of the Einstein-Hilbert action, it's just an integral d4x, integral dnw. And then I have my usual root g, gravity determinant factor. And then I have my d-dimensional Ricci scalar. And my Ricci scalar and my in this determinant factor are built out of the metric in exactly the same way that you would in four dimensions. So it's a straightforward generalization. And what we saw this earlier in our effective field theory of gravity, but we're going to do this here. This thing looks like a function of HAB. And you take this, and you plug it in here and expand it out. And the actual expansion's a mess because you have the Christoffel symbols and this and that. But what you get at the end of the day is an effective action in terms of the HAB fields. And the leading terms for this effective action are going to look something like del h squared. And then in principle, I'll have higher order interaction terms that correspond to graviton interactions. But the leading piece, and this is the piece that I'm going to apply just regular quantum field theory techniques, is the is a quadratic term, which only has a derivative piece. There's no mass term because it's gravity, and we want a massless graviton. So This thing's complicated, but morally it has this form plus some interactions, and we're going to do a KK expansion, and our KK expansion will have the following form. So as I did here, we'll assume that all the extra dimensions have the same size and are periodic with period 2 pi r. So our KK expansion will have essentially the same form as what we had here. We expand in eigenmodes of the differential operator. And we just get these exponentials summed over all n vectors n. So these n's are all the n tuples in Zn. OK, so you take this, you plug it in here, and you find that you get a massless zero mode. The massless zero mode for n equals 0 is what we'll identify with the usual graviton. But we also get towers of KK modes. And these towers of KK modes are what we expect is the KK excitations of the graviton. And we're going to have to go and look at those more carefully. So part of looking at those more carefully will also be making sure that we project out only physically interesting components of HAB. So what I mean by this is, OK, well, this is gravity. So we have general coordinate invariance. And general coordinate invariance corresponds to my GAB goes to GPQ is equal to dxA dyp dxB dyq. That's a typo in my notes, I'm afraid. OK. I'll fix that typo. But OK, in any case, you have these coordinate transformations that take the following form. So if I go from a coordinate system xA to a coordinate system yp, my effective metric for the new coordinate system looks like this. So you're describing the same physics, but with different sets of coordinates. So if I look at an infinitesimal coordinate transformation, yA is equal to xA plus a small variation that in principle depends on x. So this is my initial coordinate. This is my new coordinate. And this is a small change in the set of coordinates, which in general depend on the x's themselves. I can take this and look at how my HABs transform. And the infinitesimal transformation has the following form. So the form of my infinitesimal transformation applied to the fluctuation around the flat background, expanding out this and writing my y's as small fluctuations in the x's, takes the following form. So this is an infinitesimal transformation, coordinate transformation acting on the on the gravity fields. And the interpretation of this is that this is like a gauge transformation, in the sense that these describe the same physics, but with equivalent physics, but in different language. So we can use this invariance to choose a particular gauge, to choose some particular conditions. And a popular choice is the so-called harmonic gauge, which is we can choose del A HAV to be 1/2 del B HAA. So if I count the number of conditions that this imposes, these things are summed over, but I have a free index B. And that means that there are d unfixed components. And this corresponds to imposing d conditions on the metric. OK, so we can have residual gauge transformations beyond just this. And it turns out that even if I'm within this gauge, if I do an extra transformation by a small coordinate psi, I can stay within this gauge, provided I transform by gauge transformations with psi having del squared equals to 0.
But only for massless ones, right? Like all these gauge transformations are only gauge transformations if you have a massless graviton, right?
Well, so at this point, I'm just treating the whole field at once.
Okay.
So the whole field has this invariance. So this story will apply in general. So we don't actually have a mass term for gravity in here. So we're still safe doing this. Okay. But the fact that we can still transform by so-called harmonic functions, that's why this is called a harmonic gauge, means that we can pull off another D components. So if you look at the number of components in GAB, GAB is a two-index symmetric tensor. And a two-index symmetric tensor has d plus 1 over 2 components, but we've imposed d conditions. So we subtract off 2d. And what we're left with is d minus 3 over 2, which I can rewrite d as, remember, my d is 4 plus n up here. So I can rewrite this in terms of n. And this just turns out to be, in terms of the n components, n plus 1, n plus 4 over 2. So after fixing these gauges with these conditions, this is the number of independent degrees of freedom we have left in the metric. And it turns out that these degrees of freedom are essentially can be identified more or less with physical degrees of freedom. And this counting will be important at the KK level. OK, so since we're four-dimensional observers, we're going to want to decompose our d-dimensional graviton in terms of four-dimensional components. So what I mean by that, in terms of things with well-defined transformations under the four-dimensional subgroup of the full d-dimensional space. So this corresponds to taking our modes HAB of n, and we can separate them into the following combinations. You can separate them into things that transform like two-index symmetric tensors under Lorentz. We can separate them into things that transform like a one-index tensor, which we're going to write as these things transform as vectors. So we're going to write this as Vn of mu a. So these components of the graviton excitation under the four-dimensional space transform like vectors. And finally, we have things that transform like scalars with no mu nu indices that under the four-dimensional subspace transform act like scalars. And I'm going to write these as S n of AB, where here the V stands for vector, the S stands for scalar. OK, so now if we look at the decomposition, we can look at zero modes, and then we can look at the KK modes, and count everything up and see what couples to what. OK, so the zero mode, well, there's only one zero mode, n equals to 0. And the zero mode is independent of the extra dimension by construction. So remember, in our KK mode expansion, OK, so actually, I didn't write it here, but these HABs are only depend on the x coordinates. And all the extra dimensional dependence is in these exponentials. So for n equals to 0, our HABs are independent of W. And what we find at this level is, since we don't have any mass terms in the gravity Lagrangian, all the modes at the n equals 0 level are going to be massless as well. So the zero mode H mu nu 0 is a massless graviton. And if we count the number of degrees of freedom, because it's massless, it has 2 degrees of freedom. OK. For these vectors, these are massless vectors. And massless vectors each have 2 degrees of freedom. But because we have the A index means we have n copies. So we have n massless vectors. So this gives us 2n degrees of freedom. And finally, for the scalars, because each scalar is real, and I have n plus, because these are symmetric indices, I have n plus 1 over 2. Real scalars. So if I add these up, I have 2 plus 2n plus n plus 1 over 2 degrees of freedom, which when I put this together, let me just do the counting, gives me n squared plus 5n plus 4 over 2 degrees of freedom at this KK level. So at the zero mode level, these are my numbers of degrees of freedom. And if I compare to what I have up here, this matches the number of degrees of freedom I expect at this particular KK mode level. So this works out, but this is the massless case. The next step is let's go to the massive case. And maybe with the massive case, I'll scoot over here. OK, so in the massive case, we have mn squared. And mn squared just turns out to be n squared over r squared, or if you like, the magnitude of the n vector over r. So 1 over r sets the typical mass scale. And at each, so for each value of n, we have h mu nu of n, which is 1 massive graviton. And a massive graviton has 5 degrees of freedom. Let's see. Let me just. There are. So I'll explain this n minus 1 in a second. But anyway, this is going to give 3 times n minus 1. And so this is going to be n minus 1 over 2, if I have it right. OK, so this counting looks a little bit funny. So you might be asking, why do I have n minus 1 instead of n? And why am I subtracting off n here? And the reason for that is that there's still some extra constraints from coordinate invariants on the non-zero modes. And they correspond to na v mu a of n equals to 0. And NA SAB N equals to 0. And in each case, I have N conditions here and one condition here. So this gives me N minus 1, so minus 1 here, minus N here. And then if I count these up and work everything out, I find that I get the usual N squared plus 4N plus 5 over 2 degrees of freedom at each KK level. But the thing that happens is these different degrees of freedom reorganize themselves in a slightly different way.
Plus 5 and plus 4, right?
So. Yeah, sorry. Okay. It works. So these are extra conditions from our gauge conditions. And what's happening is that I lose n scalars, but those n scalars can be interpreted as going to give masses to massive vectors. For the appropriate number of massive vectors. But then I lose, in addition, one scalar, one set of vectors. And those are making up the extra 3 degrees of freedom to make the massive graviton. So there's something that looks a bit like a Higgs mechanism here. It's not actually a Higgs mechanism. But we're seeing that these degrees of freedom are reorganizing themselves in such a way that we have the massive states that have extra degrees of freedom within them are incorporating the would-be lower spin objects into them. in somewhat the same way that the massive vector eats a part of the Higgs boson scale. OK, so the counting of these modes works out. And this is our set of physical excitations in the theory. We have a massless graviton. So this reproduces regular GR. But we also have these massless scalars and vectors. And these are a bit worrisome. And then we have these massive KK modes. So massive KK modes are less worrisome because they're not going to mediate a long distance force, but we can still look for them in experiments. But these new massless states are worrisome because naively it seemed like they mediate long distance forces, and they might mess up what we see as gravity over long distances. So it turns out, fortunately, that's not quite the case. And that's not quite the case because we still have to look at how these modes couple to the standard model. And for our standard model coupling, let me add to the action a piece corresponding to the standard model part. And recall that the standard model is confined to a brain at W equals to 0. So the standard model action, if I write it in the full five-dimensional form, is going to have the form so we can write the standard model action in the full gravity covariant extra dimensional form, provided we stick a delta function to say that we're sequestering the standard model at W equals to 0. So if I take this and simplify, it turns out that this simplifies integral d4x. Into something that looks like this, where G is essentially the four-dimensional part of the metric. And specifically, G is G mu nu of x is my induced metric. So in other words, G mu nu at x, W equals to 0. So it's the metric at W equals to 0 obtained by sequestering at that one point. And I can take this, and I can expand these g's around this the full GAB. And I can expand it both using the flat space background plus the leading fluctuation in the graviton modes. So it turns out that what you get by doing that is the following interaction terms. I get integral d4x times 1 over m star 1 plus n over 2. 1 over the n-dimensional volume times something with the regular energy momentum tensor of the standard model coupling to regular graviton KK modes plus some order 1 coupling of the trace of the energy momentum transfer of the standard model to a combination of the scalars. So let me just put it in brackets. And here, T mu nu is the energy momentum tensor of the standard model, which one way to define it is as follows. You've seen the energy momentum tensor before. It comes up in various parts, and it corresponds to conserved energy momentum. So what we see here is the standard model talks to gravity in the usual way through this piece. So for n equals to 0, this is the usual gravity coupling. But we also see that there are new couplings of the standard model to the graviton KK modes. And the coupling to the graviton KK modes is of a similar form. It still goes to the energy momentum tensor. But on top of that, we also see that these scalar components couple to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. And in particular, this is a particular combination of the scalar components. And this particular component, we often call R. And sometimes we call this the radian. So two more comments. The first is that if we look at the parts of our HAB of our full five-dimensional graviton field that talks to the standard model, we see that these vector modes decouple completely. So even though we have extra massless vectors in the theory, these vector modes don't talk to the standard model at all. They only talk to other things through gravity. And we can essentially neglect them. So these things decouple from the standard model, and we can neglect them. On top of that, most of these states decouple from the standard model. The only piece that doesn't decouple from the standard model is this combination that corresponds to the radion. So looking at the set of states that couple to the standard model that are massless, the massless graviton is a usual graviton. We identify that with regular gravity, and that reproduces regular GR. We also have a new scalar coupling to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. And that massless scalar, we call a radion. And it's called a radion because there's a sense in which it corresponds to fluctuations in the sizes of these extra dimensions. And one thing we haven't put in self-consistently in the theory is a mechanism to stabilize the radii of the large extra dimensions to be what they are. So we're not going to say too much more about the radion, but in general, we expect some mechanism has to come in to stabilize the sizes of these extra dimensions. And along the way, we expect that mechanism to stabilize the sizes of the extra dimensions is going to give the radion a mass, and then take care of this problem. So we're not going to worry too much more about the radion. We're just going to concentrate on the effects of the new KK gravitons coupling to the standard model. Yeah.
What standard model fields contribute to the trace of the momentum tensor?
The trace of the energy momentum tensor, typically, in a sense, it connects to masses in the standard model. So there's a sense in which it measures the deviations of the standard model from being a scale invariant theory. So it has contributions from physical masses of particles, and it also has contributions from quantum effects like beta functions. But OK, in any case, this radion being massless corresponds to the fact that this system isn't stable or is metastable against expanding or contracting. So there's nothing stabilizing that radius. One thing we need to put in to fix the theory is a mechanism that should give the radion a mass by giving it an effective potential. Having said that, this picture of large extra dimensions as a solution to the hierarchy problem is slightly problematic because, in a sense, we haven't solved the hierarchy problem. We've just moved it to a new problem. So we've addressed the hierarchy problem in that now the weak scale can be close to the fundamental scale of quantum gravity. So there's no secret hierarchy, and there's no sense in which you can go a lot higher than the weak scale. On the other hand, though, we still have this problem of explaining why these extra dimensions are as big as they are. And that's highly non-trivial and possibly as difficult as a hierarchy problem to start with. So this picture is, so while it's interesting and it's a nice way to recast the hierarchy problem, isn't necessarily an actual solution to the hierarchy problem. But it's we're going to take this, bounce off it, and look at a slightly different realization that does give a very nice realization of a solution to the hierarchy problem. So I guess I've moved over time, so let's go reconnect tomorrow.